Several of his friends have been called up, but they are all French. He'd hoped that as a foreigner he might be exempt. Perhaps, he thinks, there is a way out of this. But the small print at the bottom of the slip suggests otherwise. Failure to report to duty will result in arrest and incarceration. Merde. He is in good health, of fighting age. No, there is no way out. Merde, merde, merde! Four stories below, Moretti's Occitan cross, inlaid on the paving stones, reflects beneath the street lamps like a giant granite tattoo. Overhead, a half-moon is on the rise. How is it possible, Addie wonders, that amid such serenity, a war is being waged across the border? Where are Genek and Jakob now? Are they awaiting orders? Are they in combat at this very moment? Addie glances up at the sky, picturing his brothers pressed shoulder to shoulder in a trench, oblivious of the rising moon, thinking only of the mortars flying overhead. Addie's eyes begin to water. He slips a hand into his trouser pocket and retrieves his handkerchief, a gift from his mother. She'd given it to him a year ago, when he was home last for Rosh Hashanah. She'd found the fabric in Milan, she said, on one of her buying trips, a soft white linen to which she'd hand-stitched a small border and embroidered his initials in the corner, A-A-I-K, Adi Abraham Israel Kurtz. It's beautiful, Adi had declared when his mother handed him the handkerchief. Oh, it's nothing, Nehuma had replied. But Addie knew how much care she'd put into making it, how much pride she took in her craft. He rubs his thumb over the embroidery, imagining his mother at work in the back room of the shop, a bolt of cloth laid out before her, her tape measure, scissors, and red silk pincushion at her side. He can see her measuring her thread, twisting an end between her fingers and bringing it to her lips to wet it, before guiding it through the impossibly small eye of a needle. Addie breathes deeply, feeling the rise and fall of his chest. It's going to be all right, he tells himself. Hitler will be stopped. France hasn't seen any fighting yet. For all one knows, the war will be over before it does. Perhaps his friends in Toulouse, who had begun to call it the drôle de guerre, the phony war, were right. And it is only a matter of time before he'll be able to return to Poland, to his family, to the life he'd left behind when he moved to France. Addie thinks about how, a year ago, if someone had offered him a job in New York City, he'd have likely jumped at the opportunity. Now, of course, he would do anything, anything, just to be home, sitting at his mother's dining room table, surrounded by his parents, his siblings. He folds his handkerchief back into his pocket. Home. Family. Nothing is more important. He knows that now.
September 22, 1939. The city of Lvov surrenders to the Soviet Red Army. September 27, 1939. Poland falls. Hitler and Stalin immediately divide the country. Germany occupies the western region, including Radom, Warsaw, Krakow, Lublin, and the Soviet Union occupies the eastern region, including Lvov, Pinsk, Vilna.
Chapter 7. Jakob and Bella. Lvov, Soviet-occupied Poland, September 30, 1939. Bella checks the brass number hanging on the red door. 32, she whispers under her breath, comparing it twice with the address scrawled in Jakob's handwriting on the letter she'd carried with her from Radom. 19 Kalinina Street, apartment 32. Jakob's camera hangs around her neck, his coat over her forearm, folded to conceal the layers of mud it had collected en route. Never before has she been so filthy. She'd peeled off a pair of ripped stockings, cursing the loss, and tried her best to stomp the mud from the soles of her shoes and to wipe her face clean, licking her thumb and dabbing at her cheeks. But without a mirror, the effort was useless. Her hair is as unruly as a thorn bush, and she's still damp beneath her layers. When she lifts her arms, the smell is appalling. How she needs a wash. She must look awful. Never mind. You're here. You've made it. Just knock. Her fist hovers a few centimeters from the door. Taking a slow, deep breath, she licks her lips and taps her knuckles softly on the wood, tilting her head forward, listening. Nothing. She knocks again, louder this time. She's about to knock a third time when she hears the faint clip of footsteps. Her heart raps in sync with each step as it grows louder, and for a moment she panics. What if she's greeted, after coming all this way, not by her Jakob, but by a stranger? Who is it? A puff of air escapes her lips, a laugh, her first in weeks, and she realizes she's been holding her breath. It's him. Jakob, Jakob, it's me, she says to the door, levitating to her toes, suddenly feather light. Before she can add, it's Bella, there's a quick metallic click, a deadbolt sliding in its mount, and the door swings open forcefully, pulling with it a vacuum of air. And then, there he is, her love, her ukohani, looking at her, into her, and beneath the layers of grime and sweat and stink, somehow, she feels beautiful. It's you, Jakob whispers. How did you come in quickly? He pulls her inside and locks the door behind them. She sets his coat and camera on the floor, and when she stands, his hands are on her shoulders. He holds her gently, his gaze traveling the length of her, studying her. In his eyes, Bella sees the worry, the exhaustion, the disbelief. Whatever has happened here in Lvov has left a mark on him. He hasn't slept, it seems, in days. Kuba, she starts, calling him as she sometimes does by his Hebrew name, wanting nothing but to assure him that she's okay, she's here now, he mustn't worry. But he isn't ready yet to talk. He pulls her to him, enveloping her so fully she can hardly breathe. And in that instant, she knows she was right to come. With her arms tucked beneath his, she presses her head into the familiar crook of his neck, running her forearms up the narrow of his back. He smells, as he always does, of wood chips and leather and soap. She can feel his heart beating against hers, the weight of his cheek heavy on her head. Beneath his shirt, his shoulder blades protrude like boomerangs, sharper than she remembers. They stand like this for a full minute, until Jakob leans back, lifting her with him, up and up until her feet float from the ground. He laughs, spinning around, and soon the room melts out of focus, and she's laughing too. As her toes touch the floor, Jakob leans forward. She lets the weight of her torso dissolve into his arms, and as he dips her, she tips her head back, feeling the blood rush to her ears. He cradles her there for a moment, dangling in his arms, the final exultant posture of a ballroom dance, before pulling her to her feet. Jakob stares at her again, holding both her hands, his expression suddenly serious. I can't believe you made it, he says, shaking his head. I got your letter just after the fighting started, and then we were mobilized, and by the time I returned you still weren't here. Had I known it would be this bad, Bella, I promise I would never have asked you to come. I've been so worried. I know, love, I know. I don't know how you made it. We nearly turned back on several occasions. You have to tell me everything. I will, but first a bath, please, Bella smiles. Jakob sighs, his eyes softening. What would I have done if... Shh, Kohani. It's okay, darling. I'm here. Jakob tucks his chin so his forehead rests gently on Bella's. "Thank you," he whispers, closing his eyes, "for coming." They sit at a small square table in the kitchen, their hands wrapped around mugs of hot black tea. Bella's hair is still wet from her bath, the skin of her neck and cheeks flushed pink. She'd scrubbed herself clean and soaked for all of 3 minutes, before Jakob tapped softly on the washroom door, undressed, and climbed into the tub with her. "I honestly didn't think it would work," Bella says. She's just finished explaining Tomek's plan, how petrified she was of being discovered, turned back, or taken captive. Tomek, it turns out, had been right about the German front line. She was able to skirt it by crossing the meadow where he left her. But when she reached the forest on the other side, she lost her sense of direction and veered north, walking for hours until finally stumbling across a pair of train tracks, which she followed to a small station on the outskirts of the city. There, despite her muddy, pathetic state, she talked her way through one last checkpoint, bought a one-way ticket with her remaining zloty, and rode the last several kilometers to Lvov by train. "I was surprised when I got here," Bella says. "I didn't see Wehrmacht on the streets. I expected to find the city swarming." Jakob shakes his head. "The Germans are gone," he says quietly. "Lvov is Soviet-occupied now. Hitler pulled his men out a few days before Poland fell." "Wait, what?" "Lvov fell just 3 days before Warsaw." "Poland has fallen?" The color has left Bella's cheeks. Jakob takes her hand. "You haven't heard?" "No," Bella whispers. Jakob swallows, seeming unsure of where to begin. He clears his throat and explains as succinctly as he can what Bella has missed, telling her how the Poles in Lvov had waited for days for help from the Red Army, which was stationed just east of the city, how they thought the Soviets had been sent to protect them, and how, after a while, it became clear that wasn't the case. He describes how completely outnumbered they were, how, when the city finally surrendered, General Sikorsky, head of the Polish military, negotiated a pact that allowed Polish officers to leave the city. "Register yourself with Soviet authorities and go home," the general said. Jakob pauses, peers for a moment into his mug. "But just after the Germans left, dozens of Polish officers were arrested by the Soviet police without explanation. That's when I scrapped my uniform," Jakob adds, "and decided I'd be better off hiding out here, waiting for you." Bella watches Jakob's Adam's apple travel up and down the length of his throat. She is stunned. "A few days later," Jakob continues, "after Warsaw fell, Hitler and Stalin split Poland in two, right down the middle. The Nazis took over the west, the Red Army the east. We're on the Soviet side here in Lvov, which is why you didn't see any Germans." Bella can barely speak. "The Soviets are on the side of the Germans, and Poland has fallen. Did you have to..." But she trails off, the words jammed in the roof of her mouth. "There was fighting," Jakob says, "and bombing. The Germans dropped loads of bombs. I saw people die. I saw horrible things. But no," he sighs, looking at his hands, "I didn't have to. I didn't manage to hurt anyone." "And what of your brother Genek and Selim and Adam?" "Genek and Adam are here in Lvov. But Selim, we haven't heard from him since the Germans retreated." Bella's heart sinks. "And the officers they arrested?" "No one's seen them since." "My God," she whispers. It's dark in the bedroom, but from the sound of Jakob's breathing next to her, Bella can tell that he is awake too. She'd nearly forgotten how lovely it felt to lie down for a night's sleep on a mattress. It was heaven compared to the wooden floorboards of Tomek's wagon. Rolling to face Jakob, she loops a bare calf over his knee. "What should we do?" she asks, Jakob sandwiches her leg between his. She can feel him looking at her. He finds her hand, kisses it, and brings her palm to his chest.
We should get married.
Bella laughs. I miss that sound, Jakob says, and Bella can tell that he's smiling. Of course, she'd meant what should they do next, as in, should they stay in Lvov or return to Radom? They haven't discussed yet which option is safest. She presses her nose and then her lips to his, holding the kiss for a few seconds before pulling away. Are you serious? She breathes. You can't be serious. Jakob. She wasn't expecting the subject of marriage to come up, not on the first night together again, at least. The war, it seems, has emboldened him. Of course I'm serious. Bella closes her eyes, her bones sinking heavily into the mattress beneath her. They can talk about their plan tomorrow, she decides. Was that a proposal? She asks. Jakob kisses her chin, her cheeks, her forehead.
I guess that depends on what your answer is, he says finally.
Bella smiles.
You know what my answer is, love.
She rolls over and he pushes his knees into the backs of hers, wraps his arms around her, cocooning her in his warmth. They fit perfectly together.
Then it's a deal, Jakob says.
Bella smiles.
It's a deal. I still can't believe you're really here, Jakob whispers. I was so scared you wouldn't make it.
I was so scared I wouldn't find you.
Let's not do that again.
What again?
I mean, let's not ever be apart, ever again.
It was... His voice fades to a whisper.
It was awful.
Awful, Bella agrees.
Together from now on, all right? No matter what.
Yes. No matter what. Chapter 8. Halina. Radom. German-occupied Poland. October 10, 1939. Gripping a knife in her free hand, Halina blows a wisp of blonde hair from her eyes and rocks forward onto her knees. Pressing a clump of pink beet stems against the earth, she flexes her jaw, raises her blade, and brings it down with as much force as she can muster.
Thwack!
Earlier in the day, she learned that if she put enough muscle into it, she could slice off the stems in one motion instead of having to go at each plant twice. But that was hours ago. Now, she's spent. Her arms feel as if they are hewn from oak, as if they may split at any moment from her shoulders. Now it takes two, sometimes three attempts.
Thwack!
Her brothers had written recently from Lvov, where they reported that the Soviets have assigned them desk jobs.
Desk jobs?
The news has begun to irk her. How is it that she, of all people, has ended up in the fields? Before the war, Halina worked as an assistant to her brother-in-law Salim at his medical lab, where she wore a white coat and latex gloves. Her hands, most certainly, were never dirty. She thinks back to her first day at the lab, to how sure she had been that she would find the work tedious, and how, after a week, she discovered that the research, the minutiae of it all, the daily potential for new discoveries, was surprisingly gratifying. She would do anything to return to her old job. But the lab, like her parents' shop, has been confiscated, and if you were a Jew out of a job, the Germans were quick to appoint you with a new one. Her parents have been dispatched to a German cafeteria, her sister Mila to a garment workshop, mending uniforms in from the German front. Halina has no idea why she was given this particular assignment. She'd assumed it was a joke, laughed even, when the clerk at the city's makeshift employment agency handed her a slip of paper with the words, "Beet Farm," written across the top. She hasn't a lick of experience harvesting vegetables. But clearly it doesn't matter. The Germans are hungry, and the plants are ready to come out of the ground. Glancing down at her hands, Halina frowns, disgusted. She can barely recognize them. The beets have stained them dark fuchsia, and in every crevice there is dirt. Beneath her fingernails, in the small folds of skin around her knuckles, stuck between flesh and the open blisters pockmarking her palms. Even worse, though, are her clothes. They're as good as ruined. She doesn't mind as much about the trousers. Thank goodness she decided to wear slacks and not a skirt. But she was particularly fond of her chiffon blouse, and her shoes are another story entirely. They are her newest pair, brogue lace-ups with a slightly squared-off toe and a small flat heel. She'd purchased them over the summer at Fogelman's and wore them today assuming she'd be assigned a task at the farm's business office, perhaps in accounting, and that it wouldn't hurt to look put together to impress her new bosses. Once a beautiful, polished Cordovan brown, the toes are now scuffed and discolored, and she can barely see the intricate decorative perforation on the sides. It's tragic. She'll have to spend hours with a sewing needle later, picking them clean. Tomorrow, she's decided, she'll dress in her shabbiest clothes, maybe borrow some things Jakob left behind. She sits back on her heels, wipes the sweat from her brow with the back of her hand, and pokes out her bottom lip as she blows again at the stubborn lock of hair tickling her face. How long, she wonders, before she's able to get a trim. Radom has been occupied for 33 days. Her salon is closed now to Jews, which is a problem as she's desperate for a haircut. Halina sighs. It's her first day at the farm, and already she's sick of it. Thwack! It feels like an eternity since her day began. She was picked up that morning by a Wehrmacht officer who wore a pressed green uniform with a crisp swastika band on his arm and a mustache so thin it appeared to have been drawn over his lip with a charcoal pencil. He'd greeted her with a glance from beneath his visored field cap and a single word. Papiere! Hellos, apparently, were too good for Jews. Then jabbed his thumb over his shoulder. Get in! Halina had climbed gingerly into the bed of the truck and found a seat among eight other workers. She recognized all but one. As they motored beneath the chestnuts flanking Warszawska Street, she refused to call it by its new German name, Poststrasse. She kept her head down for fear of being recognized. How embarrassing it would be, she'd thought, for someone from her previous life to see her being carted away like this. But when the truck paused at the corner of Kościelna Street, she looked up and managed, to her horror, to catch the eye of an old schoolmate standing by the entrance to Pomianowski's candy shop. At gymnasium, Sylvia had desperately wanted to be Halina's friend. She'd followed her around for the good part of a year before they finally grew close. They did their homework together and visited each other on weekends. One year, Sylvia invited Halina to her home for Christmas. On Nehuma's insistence, Halina brought along a tin of her mother's star-shaped almond biscuits. They'd lost touch since graduation. The last Halina knew, Sylvia had taken a job as a nurse's aide at one of the city's hospitals. All of this flashed through her mind as the truck sat idling, as the old friends stared at one another from across the cobblestone. Halina had thought for a moment about waving, as if it were perfectly normal for her to be huddled there in the back of a truck, she and eight other Jews, on their way to work. But before she could lift a hand, Sylvia narrowed her eyes and looked away. She'd pretended she didn't even know her. Halina's blood had boiled with humiliation and fury, and when the truck finally motored on, she spent the next half hour thinking of the things she'd like to say to Sylvia when she ran into her next. They drove and drove, the cityscape quickly fading, two-lane streets and 17th-century brick facades giving way to a patchwork of orchards and pasture land and narrow dirt roads hemmed in by pine and alder trees. Halina had cooled off by the time they arrived at the farm, but her bottom was bruised from all of the jostling, which made her hate the day even more. When they parked, there wasn't a building in sight, just dirt, and rows upon rows of leafy stems. It was then that Helena realized, looking out over the hectares of farmland, that this was no desk job. The officer lined them up beside the truck and tossed baskets and burlap sacks at their feet.
Stämme, he said, pointing to the sacks. Rote Rüben, he added, kicking a basket.
Though she knew enough German to get by, stems and beets weren't yet in her vernacular. But the instructions were easy enough to decipher. Stems in the sack, beets in the basket. After a moment, the officer handed each of the Jews a knife with a long, dull blade. He glared at Helena as she took hers.
Für die Stämme, he said,
resting a hand on the well-worn wooden grip of the pistol strapped to his belt. His mustache morphing along with the curve of his lips into the shape of a talon.
Brave of him giving us knives as big as these, Helena thought.
And so it went.
Thwack! Rip! Shake! Stuff! Thwack! Rip! Shake! Stuff!
Perhaps she should pocket a couple of beets to bring home to her mother. Before their food was rationed, Nehuma would grate roasted beets and toss them with horseradish and lemon to make shvikwa, pairing it with smoked herring and boiled potatoes. Helena's mouth waters. It's been weeks since her last decent meal. But something in her knows that an extra beet at dinner wouldn't be worth the consequence of getting caught stealing. A whistle shrills, and she looks up to see the silhouette of a truck 100 or so meters away, and beside it, a German officer, presumably the one who brought them, waving his cap over his head. From her plot, she can make out two of the others, already walking in his direction. As she stands, her muscles scream. She spent far too many hours of the day bent at right angles. She drops the knife on top of the beets in her basket and balances the wicker handle in the crook of her elbow. Wincing, she reaches for the stem-filled sack, loops its twine strap over her opposite shoulder, and begins limping toward the truck. The sun has dipped behind the tree line, giving the sky a pinkish hue, as if stained by the juice of the plants she'd spent all day harvesting. She'll need a warmer coat soon, she realizes. The officer whistles again, motioning for her to pick up her pace, and she curses him under her breath. Her basket is heavy. It must weigh nearly 15 kilos. She walks as quickly as her joints will allow her, wondering if any of the beets she's pulled will end up in the cafeteria where her parents work. They've been there for a week.
It's not so bad, her mother said after their first day.
Aside from having to prepare such lovely food, we'll never taste. At the truck, the officer with the flyaway mustache waits with an outstretched palm.
Das Messer, he says.
Helena hands him the knife, then sets her bag and basket on the truck bed before climbing up. The others are already seated, each looking as bedraggled as she. They retrieve a final worker and then hunker down for the ride home, their day's work at their feet, too tired to talk.
Same time tomorrow,
the German barks, as the truck slows to a stop in front of 14 Borsovska Street. It's nearly dark. He hands Helena her papers through the window of the truck's cab, along with a small, stale, 100-gram wedge of bread. Her compensation for the day.
Danke,
Helena says, taking the bread, trying to mask her sarcasm with a smile. But the officer refuses to look at her and speeds off before the word has left her lips.
Schkap,
she whispers as she turns and hobbles toward home, fishing for a key in her coat pocket. Inside, Helena finds Mila in the foyer, hanging up her coat. She has just returned from the uniform workshop. Felicia sits on a Persian rug, waving a silver rattle, smiling at its tinkly sound.
My goodness, Mila gasps,
taken aback by Helena's appearance.
What on earth did they put you up to? I've been farming, Helena says, crawling about in the fields all day. Can you believe it? You? On the farm, Mila quips, suppressing a laugh. Now there's the thought.
I know. It was dreadful. All I could think, Alina says, balanced on one foot by the door as she slips out of a shoe, wincing as she reopens a blister, was if Adam could only see me, groveling around on all fours in the dirt like an animal. What a laugh he'd get. Look at my shoes, she cries. God, what a mess.
She studies her socks, marveling at the soil they too have collected, peeling them off carefully so as not to sully the floor.
What's that? She asks, pointing to a loop of fabric draped loosely around Mila's neck.
Oh, Mila says, glancing at her chest. I forgot I was wearing it. It's something I made. I don't know what you'd call it. A harness, I suppose?
She turns, pointing to where the fabric is crisscrossed between her shoulder blades.
I can tuck Felicia inside here.
She turns again, pats the loop dangling down the length of her torso. It keeps her concealed on the way to and from the workshop. Mila brings Felicia with her to work every day, even though technically children aren't allowed.
No persons under the age of 12 in the workplace.
It's one of the Germans' many decrees, disregard of which is punishable by death. But Mila can't not work. Everyone has to work. And it's not as if she can leave Felicia, who's not even a year old, alone all day in the apartment while she's away. Halina admires her sister's ingenuity, her courage. She wonders if she were in Mila's shoes, whether she would have the gall to walk into a workshop with a child strapped illegally to her breast. Mila has changed since Salim left. Halina thinks often about how, when everything was easy, motherhood was hard for Mila. And now that everything is hard, it's a role that seems to come more naturally. It's as if some sort of sixth sense has set in. Halina doesn't worry any longer whether, with one more sleepless night, Mila might come undone.
Does Felicia like it in there, in her harness? Halina asks.
She doesn't seem to mind it.
Halina tiptoes to the kitchen as Mila begins arranging the table for dinner. Even though their meals aren't what they used to be, Nehuma still insists that they use their silver and chinaware.
What does Felicia do while you're sewing all day? She calls.
She plays beneath my work table mostly. She naps in a basket of fabric scraps. She's been incredibly patient, Mila adds. The cheerfulness has evaporated from her voice.
Bent over the kitchen sink, Halina runs water over her hands and arms, imagining her 11-month-old niece playing beneath the table for hours on end. She wishes there was something she could do to help.
Nothing from Celine today? She asks.
No.
Water splashes against the sink's metal basin, and Halina is quiet for a moment. Genek, Jakob, and Adam have all written to share the new addresses in Lvov to check in. In their letters, they say that they haven't seen Salim since the Soviets took over. Halina's heart breaks for her sister. It must be impossible not knowing where her husband is, if he's even alive. She's tried a few times to console Mila with her own outlook, which is that no news is better than bad news. But even she knows that Selim's disappearance can't be a good thing. In his last letter, Adam had confirmed what they'd read in the Tribune and in the Radomer Leben. The papers were their only source of news now, as their radios had been confiscated, that the Polish army in Lvov had disbanded and the Germans had pulled out, leaving the city in the hands of the Red Army. Not terrible was how Adam described living under the Soviets. There was plenty of work to be had, he said. He'd found a job, in fact. The pay was pitiful, but it was a job. He could find Halina one, too. And he had news. Something he had to share with her in person. He signed his letter with love and added a postscript. I think you should come to Lvov. Despite her apprehension of living under Soviet rule, the idea of moving to Lvov thrills Halina. She misses Adam deeply. His calm, reassuring way, his gentle, confident touch, the touch that made her realize that the boys she dated before him were utterly inept compared with the man that he is. She'd do anything to be with him again. Halina wonders whether his news might be a proposal. She's 22, he 32. They've been together long enough. Marriage seems the logical next step. She thinks about it often, her heart flooding at the idea of him asking for her hand, and then wringing itself dry as she realizes that to be with Adam would mean leaving Radham. No matter how she spins it, it doesn't feel right to abandon her parents. With Jakob and Genek in Lvov, who else would watch out for them? Mila has Felicia to tend to, and Adi is still stuck in France. In his last letter, he said he'd received orders to enlist, that in November he would be joining the army. And so that leaves only her. And anyway, even if she could justify going to Lvov for just a short while, with the intention of returning, the trip itself would be nearly impossible, as the latest of the Nazi decrees has robbed her of the right to leave her home or ride the train without a special pass. For now, she has no choice. She will stay put. A lock rattles, and Saul's voice echoes a moment later through the apartment as he calls for his granddaughter.
Where is my peach?
Felicia grins and pushes herself to a wobbly stand, toddling down the hallway from the dining room, her arms extended in front of her like little magnets, pulling her to her Jadek's arms. Halina and Mila follow behind. Felicia laughs as Saul scoops her up, growling playfully, nibbling on her shoulder until her giggles turn to squeals. Nehuma appears behind him, and Halina and Mila greet their parents, exchanging kisses.
Oh my, Nehuma breathes, staring at Halina's clothes. What happened?
I've been harvesting. Have you ever seen me this vile?
Nehuma studies her youngest child, shakes her head.
Never.
And you, the cafeteria? Halina asks, hanging up her mother's coat. Nehuma holds up her thumb, wrapped in a blood-stained bandage. Aside from this, it was a bore.
Mother!
Halina reaches for Nehuma's hand so she can take a closer look.
I'm fine. If the Germans would give us decent knives, I wouldn't cut myself so often. But you know what? A little blood in a kartoflanka won't kill anyone.
She smiles, pleased at her secret.
You should be more careful, Halina scolds.
Nehuma pulls her hand away and ignores the comment.
I have a treat for us, she says, extracting a handkerchief filled with a handful of potato peelings from under her blouse.
Just a few, she says, when she sees Halina's eyebrows jump.
I've peeled them thick. Look, we've got nearly half a potato here.
Halina stares.
You stole them? From the cafeteria?
No one saw me.
But what if they had?
Halina's tone is harsh, probably too harsh. It's not like her to speak like that to her mother, and she knows she should apologize. But she doesn't. It was one thing for Mila to sneak an infant into her workplace. She has no alternative but to do so. But another for her mother to steal from the Germans and then shrug it off. The room is silent. Halina, Mila, and their parents all look at one another, their gazes forming a square. Finally, Mila speaks.
It's okay, Halina. We need it. Felicia is a skeleton. Look at her.
Mother, thank you.
Come, let's make soup.
Chapter 9. Jakob and Bella. Lvov, Soviet-occupied Poland, October 24th, 1939. Bella steps carefully so as not to clip the backs of Anna's heels. The sisters move slowly, deliberately, talking in whispers. It's 9 in the evening and the streets are empty. There isn't a curfew in Lvov as there is in Radom, but the blackout is still in effect, and with the street lamps extinguished, it's nearly impossible to see.
I can't believe we didn't bring a flashlight, Bella whispers.
I walked the route earlier today, Anna says. Just stay close. I know where I'm going.
Bella smiles. Slinking through back streets in the pale blue light of the moon reminds her of the nights she and Jakob used to tiptoe at 2 a.m. from their apartments to make love in the park under the chestnut trees.
It's just here, Anna whispers.
They climb a small flight of stairs, entering the house through a side door. Inside, it's even darker than it is on the street.
Stay here for a moment while I light the match, Anna says, rummaging through her handbag.
Yes, ma'am, Bella says, laughing.
All her life, it's been she who bosses Anna about, not the other way around. Anna is the baby, the family sweetheart. But Bella knows that behind the pretty face and quiet facade, her sister is whip-smart, capable of anything she sets her mind to. Despite being 2 years younger, Anna was the first to marry. She and her husband Daniel lived just down the street from Bella and Jakob in Lvov, a circumstance that has softened Bella's pain at leaving her parents behind. The sisters see each other often and talk frequently about how to convince their parents to make the move to Lvov. But in her letters, Gustava insists that she and Henry are getting by on their own in Radom.
Your father's dentistry is still bringing a bit of income, she wrote in her last correspondence. He's been treating the Germans. It doesn't make sense for us to move, not yet at least. Just promise to visit when you can, and to write often.
How on earth did you find this place? Bella asks.
She'd been given no address, just told to follow. They'd snaked through so many narrow back alleys on their way, she'd lost her sense of direction.
Adam found it, Anna says, striking a match over and over without a spark, through the underground, she adds. Apparently, they've used it before as a sort of safe house. It's abandoned, so we shouldn't have any surprise visitors.
Finally, a match takes, emitting a cloud of sharp-smelling sulfur and an amber halo of light.
Adam said he left a candle by the faucet, she mutters, shuffling toward the sink, a hand cupped over the flame.
Adam had found the rabbi too, which Bella knew was no easy task. When Lvov fell, the Soviets stripped the city's rabbis of their titles and banned them from practicing. Those who were unable to find new jobs went into hiding. Yoffe was the only rabbi Adam could find, he said, who wasn't afraid to officiate a marriage ceremony under the condition that the wedding take place in secrecy. In the match's faint glow, the room begins to take shape. Bella looks around at the shadow of a kettle resting on a stovetop, a bowl of wooden spoons silhouetted on the counter, a blackout curtain hanging in a window over the sink. Whoever lived here left in a hurry, it seems.
It's incredibly kind of Adam to do this for us, Bella says, more to herself than to her sister.
She'd met Adam a year ago, when he leased a room in the Kurtz's apartment. Mostly she knew him as Halina's boyfriend, calm and cool and rather quiet. Oftentimes his voice was barely heard around the dinner table. But since arriving in Lvov, Adam has surprised Bella with his ability to orchestrate the impossible, handcrafting false identification cards for the family. As far as the Russians know, Adam works at an orchard outside the city, harvesting apples. But in the underground, he has become a prized counterfeiter. By now, hundreds of Jews have pocketed his IDs, which he produces with such a meticulous hand, Bella would swear they are real. She'd asked him once how he was able to make them look so authentic.
They are authentic, the stamps at least, he'd said, explaining how he discovered that he could remove official government stamps from existing IDs with a peeled, just-boiled egg.
I lift the original when the egg is still hot, Adam said. Then roll the egg over the new ID. Don't ask why, but it works.
Found it.
Darkness envelops them once again as Anna fumbles for another match. A moment later, the candle is lit. Bella removes her coat, lays it over the back of a chair.
Cold in here, Anna whispers. Sorry.
Carrying the candle, she makes her way from the sink to stand beside Bella.
It's okay, Bella suppresses a shiver. Is Jakob already here? And Genek? Herta? It's so quiet.
Everyone's here. Getting settled in the foyer, I imagine.
So I'm not to be married in the kitchen?
Bella laughs and then sighs, realizing that for as many times as she told herself she'd marry Jakob anywhere, the idea of wedding him here, in the shadowy, ghost-like home of a family she'll never know, was beginning to make her feel uneasy.
Please, you're far too classy for a kitchen wedding.
Bella smiles.
I didn't think I'd be nervous. It's your wedding day. Of course you're nervous.
The words reverberate through her and Bella goes still.
I wish Mother and Father could be here, she says finally.
And as she hears herself, her eyes well up with tears. She and Jakob had talked about waiting until the war was over to marry, so they could hold a more traditional ceremony in Radom with their families. But there was no telling when the war would end. They'd waited long enough, they decided. The Tatars and the Kurtzes had both given their blessings from Radom. They'd practically begged Jakob and Bella to marry. Still, Bella hates that her parents can't be with her. Hates that, despite how happy she is now that she's with Jakob, she's also guilty for it. Is it right, she wonders, to celebrate while her country is at war, while her parents are alone in Radom? Her parents who, for all of her life, have given her so much when they had so little. Bella's memory flashes to the day when she and Anna returned home from school to find their father in the living room with a scruffy-looking dog at his feet. The pup was a gift, their father told them, from one of his patients who had fallen on hard times and was unable to pay to have a tooth extracted. Bella and Anna, who had begged for a dog since they were toddlers, had shrieked with joy and rushed to hug their father, who wrapped his arms around them, laughing as the dog nipped playfully at their ankles. Anna squeezes her hand.
I know, she says. I wish they could be here too. But they want this so badly for you. You mustn't worry about them. Not tonight.
Bella nods.
It's just so far from what I imagined, she whispers.
I know, Anna says again, her voice soft. When they were teenagers, Bella and Anna would lie in bed and talk for hours, concocting stories of their wedding days. At the time, Bella could see it perfectly, the sweet-smelling bouquet of white roses her mother would arrange for her to carry, the smile on her father's face as he lifted her veil to kiss her forehead beneath the chuppah, the thrill of Jakob slipping a ring over her index finger, a symbol of their love that she would carry with her for the remainder of her lifetime. Her wedding, had it been in Radom, would have been far from lavish, this she knows. It would have been simple, beautiful. What it would not have been was a secret ceremony, held in the cold carcass of an abandoned, blacked-out house, 500 kilometers from her parents. But, Bella reminds herself, she'd chosen to come to Lvov after all. She and Jakob had decided together to marry here. Her sister is right. Her parents have wanted this for her for years. She should focus on what she has, not what she doesn't. On this night, especially.
No one could have predicted this, Anna adds. But just think, she says, her voice growing more chipper. The next time you see Mama and Tata, you will be a married woman. Hard to believe, isn't it?
Bella smiles, willing away her tears.
It is, in a way, she whispers,
thinking about her father's letter, which had arrived 2 days ago. In it, Henry described how overjoyed he and Gustava were upon learning of her intent to marry.
We love you so much, dear Bella. Your Jakob is a good soul, that boy, with a fine family. We will celebrate all of us when we are together again.
Rather than show the letter to Jakob right away, Bella had slipped it under her pillow and decided she'd let him read it later that evening, once they'd returned to their apartment, a married couple. Sucking in her stomach, Bella runs her hands along the lace bodice of her dress.
I'm so happy it fits, she says, exhaling. It's just as beautiful as I remember it.
When Anna became engaged to Daniel, their mother, knowing that they couldn't afford the kind of dress Anna would want from a dressmaker, decided to make a gown herself. She, Bella, and Anna had scoured the pages of McCall's and Harper's Bazaar for the designs they liked. When Anna finally picked her favorite, inspired by film stills of Barbara Stanwyck, the Tatar woman spent an entire afternoon at Nahuma's fabric shop, poring over bolts of various satins, silks, and laces, marveling over how luxurious each felt as they rubbed it between their fingers. Nahuma gave them the materials they finally selected at cost, and it took Gustava nearly a month to finish the gown, a V-neck, with a white lace-trimmed bodice, long gathered gifts and sleeves, buttons down the back, a bell-shaped skirt that fell just to the floor, and a powder-white satin sash tied at her hips. Delighted, Anna deemed it a masterpiece. Bella had secretly hoped she'd get to wear it someday.
I'm just happy I brought it, Anna says. I almost left it with Mother, but I couldn't bear to part with it.
Oh, Bella, Anna stands back to take her in. You look so beautiful.
Come, she says, adjusting the gold brooch hanging around Bella's neck so it sits perfectly centered in the hollow between her collarbones.
Before I cry, are you ready?
Almost.
Bella fishes a metal tube from her coat pocket. She removes the lid, then swivels the bottom a half turn and applies a few dabs of peppercorn red lipstick carefully to her lips, wishing she had a mirror.
I'm glad you brought this too, she says,
rubbing her lips together before dropping the tube back into her pocket. And that you are willing to share, she adds. When lipstick was pulled from the market, the army had better use for petroleum and castor oil. Most women they knew clung fiercely to what was left of their supplies.
Of course, Anna says. So, готова?
Ready. Carrying the candle in one hand, Anna guides Bella gently through a doorway. The foyer is dimly illuminated by two small votives propped on the staircase balusters. Jakob stands at the foot of the stairs. At first, all Bella can make out of him is his silhouette, his narrow torso, the gentle slope of his shoulders.
We'll save this one for later, Anna says, snuffing out her candle. She kisses Bella on the cheek. I love you, she says, beaming, and then makes her way to greet the others.
Bella can't see them, but she can hear whispers.
Oh, Jakob Jenkna, beautiful.
A second silhouette stands motionless beside her groom, the candlelight catching the frizz of a long silver beard. It must be the rabbi, Bella realizes. She steps into the flickering glow of the votives, and as she slides her elbow through Jakob's, she feels the tightness between her ribs disappear. She isn't nervous anymore, or cold. She's floating. Jakob's eyes are wet when they meet hers. In her sister's ivory heels, she's nearly as tall as he. He plants a kiss on her cheek.
Hello, sunshine, he says, smiling.
Hi, Bella replies, grinning.
One of the onlookers chuckles. The rabbi extends a hand. His face is a maze of wrinkles. He must be in his 80s, Bella guesses.
I am Rabbi Yofi, he says. His voice, like his beard, is rough around the edges.
Pleasure, Bella says, taking his hand and dipping her chin.
His fingers feel frail and knotted between hers, like a cluster of twigs.
Thank you for this, she says, knowing what a risk he'd taken to be there.
Yofi clears his throat.
Well, shall we get started?
Jakob and Bella nod.
Jakob, Yofi begins, repeat after me.
Jakob does his best not to bungle Rabbi Yofi's words, but it's difficult, partly because his Hebrew is rudimentary, but mostly because he's too distracted by his bride to keep a thought in his mind for more than a few seconds, She is spectacular in her gown. But it's not the dress he's taken by. He's never seen her skin so smooth, her eyes so bright, her smile, even in the shadows, such a perfect, radiant Cupid's bow. Against the ebony backdrop of the abandoned house, ensconced in the golden glimmer of candlelight, she appears angelic. He can't take his eyes off her. And so he stumbles through his prayers, thinking not about his words, but about the image of his soon-to-be wife before him, memorizing her every curve, wishing he could snap a photo so he could show her later on just how beautiful she looked. Yoffi pulls a handkerchief from his breast pocket, places it over Bella's head.
"Walk 7 times, he instructs,
drawing an imaginary circle on the floor with his index finger.
"Around Jakob."
Bella extracts her elbow from Jakob's and obeys, her heels clicking softly on the wooden floorboards as she walks a circle, and then two. Each time she passes in front of him, Jakob whispers,
"You are exquisite."
And each time, Bella blushes. When she has returned to Jakob's side, Yoffi offers a short prayer and reaches again into his pocket, this time removing a cloth napkin folded in two. He opens it, revealing a small light bulb with a broken filament. A functioning light is too precious to break now.
"Don't worry, it no longer works," he says,
wrapping up the bulb and bending slowly to place it at their feet. Something creaks, and Jakob wonders whether it's the floorboards or one of the rabbi's joints.
"In the midst of this happy occasion," Yoffi says, righting himself, "we should not forget how fragile life truly is. The breaking of glass, a symbol of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, of man's short life on earth."
He motions to Jakob and then to the floor. Jakob brings a foot down gently on the napkin, resisting the urge to stomp for fear that someone might hear.
"Mazel tov!"
the others cry softly from the shadows, also straining to subdue their cheers. Jakob takes Bella's hands, weaving his fingers between hers.
"Before we finish," Yoffi says,
pausing to look from Jakob to Bella,
"I would like to add that, even in the darkness, I see your love. Inside, you are full, and through your eyes it shines."
Jakob tightens his grip on Bella's hand. The rabbi smiles, revealing two missing teeth, then breaks into song as he recites a final blessing.
"You are blessed, Lord our God, the sovereign of the world, who created joy and celebration, bridegroom and bride, rejoicing, jubilation, pleasure and delight, love and brotherhood, peace and friendship."
The others sing along, clapping softly as Jakob and Bella seal the ceremony with a kiss.
"My wife," Jakob says, his gaze dancing across Bella's face. The word feels new and wonderful on his lips. He steals a second kiss. "My husband."
Hand in hand, they turn to greet their guests who emerge from the shadows of the foyer to embrace the newlyweds. A few minutes later, the group is assembled in the dining room for a makeshift dinner, a meal smuggled in under their coats. It's nothing fancy, but a treat nonetheless. Horse meat burgers, boiled potatoes, and homemade beer. Gennet clinks a fork gently against a borrowed glass and clears his throat.
"To pan I pani kurz," he says, his glass lifted. "Mazel tov."
Jakob consents how difficult it is for Gennet to keep his voice low.
"Mazel tov," the others echo. "And it only took 9 years, Gennet adds, grinning.
Beside him, Hertha laughs.
"But seriously, to my little brother and to his ravishing bride, who we've all adored since the day we met. May your love be everlasting. L'chaim.
L'chaim," the others repeat in unison. Jakob raises his glass, smiling at Genek, and wishing, as he often does, that he'd proposed sooner. Had he asked for Bella's hand a year ago, they would have celebrated with a